Welcome to Activate Yourself with Gita Sidhu Rob, where we feature otherwise normal people who, because of events in their life, have turned left and done unusual, inspiring, incredible things, like build a business, become a happiness expert, marry a prince, create an empire, or like your host, set up a health and wellness business, Nosh Detox. Here's your host, Gita Sidhu Rob.
Hi, my name is Gita Sidhu Rob, and this is Activate Yourself. And I always, my goal is to bring you somebody in this conversation that inspires you to think that just because life forced you to turn left, it doesn't mean it was a bad thing. It forced you to turn left because it wanted you to activate your superpower. And today's guest is a fantastic example of this. If honestly, she's a little bit like having hit a bowling ball. I met her and then my life was never the same. And I love her. And I was like, you have to come on so we can talk about how this works. So let's welcome Dr. Nita Bhushan. Nita, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh my gosh, Gita. I'm so excited to be here. And what an amazing intro.
Yeah, well, because it's so true. The thing I find is that most people, when things go bad, think that the bad thing is the beginning and the end of everything. But in fact, what I like about you and some of my other guests is that you personify that when one door closes, it's literally because the other door is opening, bish, just turn around and look the other way. And so you started off as a dentist.
I did. Not just a dentist, a cosmetic dentist, because, you know, dentist just wasn't good enough.
No.
And I mean, so that was the criteria. And also, I wasn't just a cosmetic dentist. I owned my practice, which was obviously unheard of for somebody who's, you know, 27, 28, right out of school.
Yeah.
And to be one of the few women in my class, out of a class of like 70, there was less than half were women, even probably less than that, I want to say. And I was one of the few that purchased a practice right out of dental.
I just think that's amazing. I wonder if another really interesting version of this is, I wonder if ambition is born or created, you know, the ambitiousness.
With my thing with ambition, I think also culturally we come from backgrounds where you are born and raised thinking that, you know, the mediocre is not there, that mediocre doesn't exist, that you are always striving for success, always striving for excellence. And, you know, in our cultures from immigrant households, my dad was Punjabi, my mom was Filipino, was a metric of success, how much accolades, the achievements, et cetera. And then you go into this wave and even a coping mechanism of the overachieving, the overdoing. And also, I mean, at the very beginnings of it, our worthiness and our acceptance and our validation from the closest people to us, which are family members. And if they don't accept anything less than an A, then the perfectionism and the constant striving for more and more and more just never ends. So I think there's also baked into that, that's kind of where the seeds of ambition is born. And I think it's also a little bit of the resiliency as well, right? Because when you go back to India or the Philippines, you see the struggle is real. Doesn't matter, you know, which social system you grew up in, you go back and you can just see that there is poverty everywhere. There are different class systems. And then even as a young child, for me to go at 3, at 5, at 7, to actually see that, to say, oh, okay, yeah, all right, we're going to go to our nani's house or our daddy's house and not have the running water. And you just learn how to, you know, do your business in a hole back then. And yes. So that is kind of the idea of like, all right, we don't want our children to, you know, it's ancestral. I think that we obviously want to leave the generation behind us in a better way, shape, and form, or at least that was kind of my upbringing. And so when you ask, ambition, you know, created. I think that, you know, with our upbringing, and there's a concept that I even talk about in our book, my latest book, That Sucked, Now What, you have what's called the bounce factor. And so the bounce factor has four parts. The first part is kind of understanding your upbringing, right? All of the things that we were told, all of the things that we accepted for, which then drove the overachieving, the overcompensation, but then it's also the environment. And so if you're exposed to certain environments that aren't just helicopter parenting, or that aren't just everything's laid for you on a platter, you are going to want to, you know, go, I think, the extra mile. And that's literally baked in.
I think that's, yeah, it sounds phenomenal, because I think it's that concept of what you're saying is that whatever you do have gets so honed that actually achievement almost becomes of constructive value. You know?
Yes. Yes. It's a value where you, it's almost, you know, I would say it's part of the chase, but it's also part of the operating system of your lineage, because that was constantly baked into you, right?
Yeah.
Like, for instance, you know, I think in, you know, the Americas or even the UK, there is a baked in effort of sports and doing sports and doing sports after school, or doing, you know, let's just say basketball here in the States, maybe it's soccer or football in the UK. And you go to India and they don't really have that. It's not like you're taking your kids to cricket, no. You know, in cricket leagues every weekend, you know, maybe tennis. That's like the thing that all, you know, they see play really, but that's not a thing. Whereas in India, it's like tuition, you're going to go to tuition. It's and that's fun. From like, you know, everyone had asked me like, are your kids going to go? Cause now my son is four. I'm like, should he be reading at 4 years old? Oh my God, what am I doing as a parent? You know? And that goes back to our lineage versus if I talk to one of my friends who I grew up in the city of Chicago, where they're playing basketball at the age of 2 and 3 to get into whatever the league is, to get into whatever scholarship that they could get into, the priorities are a little different.
So the other thing that I wonder about when I was reading your book is that when I was going through That Sucks, Not What, one of the things I really cared about and I have always wanted to ask you is, how do you think your mixed lineage helps you to get over being stuck? Because I say this because, you know, my kids are mixed, heavily mixed, in that they just look like a complete, like I was not their mother on any level, you know, let's be very clear. And people meet me and then I'm standing next to them and they're like, and this is, they're like, my mother. This is my mother, my blonde blue-eyed child. But I've noticed that the ability to navigate is much, much higher because either two cultures, two countries, or even two blood mixes.
Yes, no, absolutely. I think that has definitely had something to do with not only the ambition, but also the striving for, I think there's a part of wanting to fit in and wanting to belong because you're not 100% of one lineage or the other. And I think, you know, just even looking back into my upbringing, I remember there were points, you know, going to school or going to Filipino dance class where they're like, oh yeah, she's just half, you know, she doesn't speak the language. And then you go to India and then they're like, oh yeah, she's half, you know, and they'd say a derogatory word around, you know, what my other half was. And I wouldn't understand what that meant. And I'm like, okay, is that supposed to be a good thing or a bad thing? And yeah. So you grow up having this shame because you look different, because you're not 100% of one thing. And I remember even going to this, like, it was like a religious camp or spiritual camp in high school. And everyone was like the same thing. They were all, you know, a certain part of, you know, Gujarati basically. So I'm not Gujarati. I'm like half Punjabi, you know.
So you did that Northern, just to get even more screwed up. You're like,
And I'm the, and everyone knew who I was because I wasn't like a Patel. And so those things get ingrained in you of like, oh yeah, I am different because I am half this and half that. And yes. So that almost becomes like, okay, what is your identity? And that identity piece, you're constantly like, for my cousins, I wanted to fit in. So then you kind of, you're trying to gain that acceptance, gain that validation. So what? You try even harder. You have a chip on your shoulder. And that's one of the concepts that I talk about in the book is, you know, what are some of the things that you have chips on your shoulder prove others on that you can use, of course, as momentum, as inspiration, but it can also be that shadow side of wanting to be seen, the shadow side of just wanting to be accepted based on spite for somebody else. And so, you know, and then, you know, we get into even, so there is that inbuilt nature of the resiliency because you're kind of fighting against the grain. But I also think because of that resiliency, because you know, we've had to navigate through the different cultures, you kind of know like what's expected. So you almost have a little bit of street smarts. All right, here's what's going to have me win in my Indian family and what to say and what not to say. And then my Filipino family, like I knew, all right, we can have more fun. I could actually be laid back. I could talk about boys. Boys were accepted to, you know, have discussions. And it was a blast for my Indian side. I had to tone it down. I had to keep my mouth shut. I couldn't be my fullest expression because that was definitely not accepted. God forbid, you know, you'd be like the bad, the bad brown sheep. I still became one of those. I'm sure,
yeah,
you know,
no, I'm with you on that. I wore it, set fire to the death. I'm like, bring that bitch on, man.
You did too, but I think now really appreciating the uniqueness that I bring in that all mixed children or mixed folks who have mixed heritage, they bring that because they can, it's almost like using the chameleon as an advantage.
100%. I see that because I see in you, I saw it in the book and I see it in my kids. Because it's one of those things that you don't go from, you're not a people pleaser. What you actually are, that's just being Indian on its own. What you actually are,
that's true.
Is you're a corporate negotiator. You're a diplomat. You know, yeah. And it's those skills that I look at my kids and I watch them do exactly what you said. I watch them navigate. And I'm kind of like, wow, that is really, really something. But I do think of it ultimately as an advantage. I think it's difficult with the not fitting in part, but then we're creating an entire, I look at central London, every child is golden brown.
Everyone's mixed in London.
Everyone's mixed. It's the joy of living in London is every child is golden brown. I freaking love it.
It's beautiful.
You're like, what are you? Yeah. So I really love that.
Yeah. Yes, I think, you know, you guys definitely have a full melting pot, you know, it depends here on where you are, essentially. I mean, me growing up in Chicago, we definitely had a lot of that, but it wasn't as much as you see definitely in London. It's more so there's more, you know, it's like segregated, or at least where I grew up in Chicago, you had the melting pot, but then you had the Blacks, the Latinos, the Asians, the Indians, like everyone. And it's not fully, you know, fully integrated. But I think as you said, I loved what you used because it's not people pleasing. It is the diplomacy. It is truly the diplomat. Yeah.
You're really, you know, it's the one thing I noticed about you from the get-go. You're a phenomenal diplomat.
Well, thank you. My grandfather was a diplomat, so I guess I learned from him.
It'd be in the gene pools, and then you just honed that crap, right? So there we go. Okay, we're going to go for a quick break, and then I want to find out how a dentist from Chicago ends up on the stage in Mind Valley. So there's a story I'm dying to hear. It's truly the only reason I invited you on. So we're going to go on a break now.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back. How did you end up on a stage in Mind Valley?
Oh my goodness. Wow. Yes. So I actually had a lot of life happen at an early age. And I think that the biggest thing going from, you know, dentistry to a speaker, and that to one of the largest stages in personal growth in the world, it started with a full breakdown. And I thought I had reached, you know, every pinnacle of success. I became a cosmetic dentist. I literally purchased a practice pretty much right out of school about 2 years after I graduated. And I had everything. I had a picture perfect wedding that I had been planning that was going to be featured in all of these different magazines. And I thought I found my amazing partner, who was also a dentist. And there were tons of red flags, but the red flag that I was not aware of fully was, oh, I was faced with this ultimate fear. And this was a fear of my life being taken. And this happened so fast, December 31st, 2011. And where I was, my life was threatened. And pretty much within that 24 hours, I had to pack up and leave. And I was confronted with so many things at this point. What the world would think, right? What the world think? Why am I wanting to hide this level of fear and anxiety and just that I was a fraud, that I was lying this whole time, that I didn't have this perfect life, because I didn't, that I was truly broken. And I fully let myself go in every single way. I got a restraining order, and literally things completely flipped. And flipped in a way that before that whole decade of time, I didn't fully confront the fears and the pain of my past. And the pain of my past included losing my mom, my dad, and my brother all before I was 19 years old. And at 19, I was actually a caretaker to my youngest brother, Vinay, who was 14. And so my life has been marked with tons of resilience, grit. And that time, that pinnacle time, you know, December 31st, 2011 would jumpstart this next 5 years of my career, where I would just be unraveling and unearthing and shedding and clearing and allowing myself to fully go into immense amount of grief and facing the trauma head on that I had buried. I buried it under a rug. I buried all of the emotions and the full emotionality, because I was taught that I needed to be perfect. And I looked the part. I could play the part until the part was like bursting at the seams, waiting for me. And it took a very violent and toxic and abusive relationship to wake me up and say, all right, Neetha, you got to come home. You got to come home to your worst nightmare. And that is your fear of being alone, your fear of being abandoned, your fear of not finding love again, because you have to love yourself. And that was really kind of that core message of date you. I was in overlap relationships ever since I was 16 till 29. That's a very long time.
Yeah, but it provides comfort. We kind of do those things. Yeah, because it's you're trying to recreate a family to feel safe.
Oh, totally. And I think my coping mechanism was, I'm going to do whatever I can. They're toxic, even though, because I can control that narrative, control until I couldn't control. I couldn't control my parents dying of cancer. I couldn't control my brother suddenly collapsing as a sophomore after school of an asthma attack. Those things I couldn't control. I could control that, okay, I can be with this guy until it becomes completely unsafe for me to do so. And so that really charted the next years of my journey, where it was all around the healing and the deep, profound healing that came through from, you know, talk therapy, alternative modalities of healing, whether it was somatic practices, emotional practices, embodiment practices. I mean, my love of dance came through fully. And I grew up dancing, but now it was dancing just for me.
Yeah, it's an expression
form for anyone else. And so much as an expression. And it really connected me back to myself. It gave me that confidence that, okay, I might be broken, but I'm loving all of my pieces. It's like the Japanese art form of kintsugi, right? When you have tons of shattered pieces, you're lining it with gold to put it together. And how beautiful is that masterpiece? Because it's lived, and I've had such a lived experience. And that took a lot of courage, a lot of bravery to honestly go against my Punjabi family members of saying, yeah, I'm getting a divorce. And then a couple years later saying, yeah, I think I'm going to sell my practice and move to California and discover more of me. And they're like, wait, you have a practice, you have a brick and mortar, you have a building, what are you doing? And there was a lot of resistance. There were family members.
They're like, discover what? You're here. What more do you need?
Right. You've already landed. You've done all of this. Why do you still need to cry about those things? It's done. You're done. It's like, okay. I don't. And I think the biggest thing was for me, it's like, I know how much it took my parents to suppress their full emotionality and their full form of grief so badly that it took their life. And so that really started when I started to do the research, when I started to look more into mysticism and, you know, sitting with shamans and going to the ashrams my dad used to go to and visiting my own spiritual inside world that I put aside because it was something I grew up with. You know, you take for granted until they're not there. And then you're like, all I want is that safety, because that comfort of the sounds of the Gurdwara, of the sounds of temple made me feel at home. Yeah. And that was the biggest comfort. And that was really shaping my internal world. And that landed me several different opportunities. One, to speak at Google. And then I started to invest in female-led startups because I so badly wanted to create a community that I started to hang out with investors and people who were a lot smarter than me, because I was literally dying on the inside that I needed support for my dental business on the outside, that I started to associate myself with people in business. I'm like, all right, how do I focus more on my healing? So what do I need? I need to have people who can actually run my practice so that I can go to the next yoga retreat. I can go to the next meditation retreat. I can go to 3-day breathwork experience or sitting with the shamans in ayahuasca. And so that was my motivation. And that motivation literally caused the next jump and quantum leap into what I'm doing now, which is, you know, coaching and speaking. And most people wanted to know more about my story and how I had shifted my practice to be only there twice a week, even twice a month, to generate that same revenue. And then
hold on. We're going to go for a break. And then when we come back, you're going to explain, because that was an enormous vista in a very short period of time, but so interesting. We're going to go for a break.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio. UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back. And we were just at the space where you were saying, okay, they wanted to learn from you. So did you then start to teach other dentists how you did it?
Yes. So that was one. I was, of course, you know, crazy, and I love starting different projects at the same time, or at least that's kind of what I started to gather when I was doing these mini experiments, because at my core, I love bringing people together. You know this from, you know, how we've met. And that's just, I've been doing that since I was 16.
Yeah.
Because who wants to just be with their sick mom all day long? And, you know, like I was getting people together, and people would just come when they knew my brother, you know, had passed. And so we had this ongoing for most of my, you know, teenage life. And so I started to invest in female-led companies. I started to sit on these investor pitch circuits. I did a pitch as well. I didn't have a startup that I was raising money for, but I had a nonprofit and it was called An Independent Awakening. And Independent Awakening was there to help women and girls build their self-confidence from the inside out. So that's really how that coaching journey started. It started as a love and me even raising more awareness of just domestic violence for professional women, because there's a lot of that. And a lot of times in our communities, that's just a given.
Yeah.
And so it's like hush, hush under the table. You don't talk about it, but it happens. And so I got heavily involved in that women's work. And then I left for Stanford for a nonprofit management, I guess you can say, weekend executive management course. And that fully shifted my life, because that's where you would meet the VCs in Silicon Valley. That's where you would, I was the tiniest fish in that speck. You would meet people who had, people had these, you know, the Nobel laureates were there who were solving the water crisis in Africa. And I had this, you know, tiny little nonprofit that I had started. And most of those people had worked in the Bay Area. They worked for tech. They worked in startups. They were coaches mentoring these founders. And what they loved about my story was that I was just unafraid to be the smallest person in the room and openly say, hey, I'm coming from dentistry, but I'm loving this vibe, because in medicine, you are not allowed to make a mistake. And here I have all these people who are like, let's make a mistake. And, no one's going to sue you.
Yeah.
In medicine, it's like every single thing you have to notate. And that was such a huge world for me that I was fascinated and I wanted to drink more from it. And that took me on a journey of public speaking and sharing, and literally then being so fascinated around human dynamics that it influenced my very first book, Emotional Grit. And that took me across the world to 45 different countries, just doing research, sitting with about 500 different kinds of humans, whether they were Fortune 100 CEOs or they were, you know, amazing healers and shamans in their own communities. And it informed my work, and the rest is history.
Well, you know, the thing is, you're going to have to come back, because it's the friggin' history part we haven't even got to yet. And we're running out of time. And it's really irritating, because I wanted to get to that part. Okay, take me, before we finish, take me to what made you write this book. That sucks. Now what? Obviously, of your life is the reason you wrote this book, because, you know, I feel like we were born in order to push these walls. And I think women like us were born to do that. And we were born to do that at different generations and different times and different languages. So we reach more people, you know? So what made you write that book, this particular, your newest book, which has done so incredibly well?
Thank you. So I wanted to meet people where they were at. I would have tons of conversations and go into organizations and see from, you know, corporate to the doctors that were still in my community and the dentists and the burnt out professionals, as well as just your everyday younger versions of myself who got into marriages, who got into engagements just because you're supposed to, and then something happened. And so I think in transitions and seasons and stages of life, we have a lot of these shitty moments that happen. Well, for me, it was when I actually found love again and found my co-partner, and we had an amazing romance and we had our first child. And I didn't realize, but I would have such a huge initiation into motherhood with postpartum depression. And it was
terrified of losing everything again, right? I imagine.
Oh, yes. I mean, the last chapter of my book, the afterword, talks about how I did try to do everything perfect, because, you know, our ego wants us to go through the same kinds of grief again to see if we've actually integrated those parts. And for me, I thought I'd healed a lot of the wounds from the losses, but I wanted to make sure things were so perfect in this pregnancy that I was going to do it at home and do, you know, everything at home and not ever visit a hospital. Well, I'm not going to give it up, but as you can tell, it definitely wasn't that case. In fact, I actually ended up at in Compton, of all places. For those of you who don't know Compton, it is not Beverly Hills or Brentwood. Let's just say that.
I just know it from Meghan Markle. I never heard of it till they said her parents were straight out of Compton, and everybody went.
They are straight out of Compton, and that's how you guys would know what that is. Yes, and so there were 3 metal detectors when you walked in the hospital. I mean,
oh, good grief!
And I think Ari just needed to be born there to really share and give me the wisdom to say that, you know, we can try to control everything, but there is so much power and wisdom in surrender. And he is just this fearless kid and such a thoughtful boy. And truly that began a journey for me to reconcile more of the emotions that I had buried, to be more with my rage, because it wasn't just postpartum depression. It was postpartum rage. Yeah. I raged on everyone. I thought everything was crazy. Everyone was crazy. Why is, and because I couldn't accept needing help, because ever since 14 years old, I've been helping other people. I've been putting everyone else's needs before my own. So finally, for the first time, I'm being catered. I'm being mothered. I'm being nurtured.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to accept. I pushed everyone away to the point where I would make people cry. And this is my closest family members. I said things that were awful, but it's like the little girl or the little teenager at 14 was like, why is this happening? Like, I can't control this. And I need to be heard. And that part of me was like yearning to come to the full frontal frame. Mm-hmm. And now I needed to allow her to express fully so she could heal. And that's the reason why I wrote That Suck Now What. It was because there is duality of our emotions. There's duality in our experiences. And many times we're told to shut the 7-year-old part of us that's so excited about a boy, or the 17-year-old part of us that's jealous because she didn't get the part in the lead play. But they all exist. And to give notice to all of these also emotions. And that's kind of where That Sucked Now What, How to Embrace the Joy and Chaos and Find Magic in the Mass, was really born, as an homage to my younger self, the little girl that had to grow up, the teenager that couldn't express and feel. But then she had to when she became a mom.
Mm-hmm. And also because nothing would allow you not to be the best mom in the world. That makes that. But I love that. And I'm really, thank you for sharing all that, because there is a place where I honestly think that when we don't talk about women being angry enough, and we don't acknowledge, literally, I used to laugh about it because I used to say, give a woman a Kalashnikov and then she'll tell you exactly, you know, there's just... If we didn't manage this process so friggin' well, it's a miracle that all serial killers are really men, basically, because the level of anger. But what we do as women is we turn our anger on ourselves, because it's not an external facing thing, you know, and we hurt ourselves with it. It was amazing. Well, we're just going to have to keep doing this because obviously, you know, it's a life much lived, yours. Which makes me feel very happy, because I often worry about having a life overlived. And I'm just like, I'll be like, look at Nika. I'll be using you as that example. So just such a joy having you on. Thank you. And I know everybody can get your book from everywhere. So please buy it. Please download it. Please read it. It's phenomenal. And you'll see why, because Nita is also phenomenal. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Geeta. It was a pleasure.
It's so nice to have you. My name is Geeta Sidhurob. And well, it's also Geeta Sidhurob if I'm talking to Nita, because, you know, we'll just be Indian about that. And this is Activate Yourself. Thank you very much for listening to us. I hope you found it inspiring and interesting and enjoyable and thought-provoking, because really growth does not come through pain, no matter what people tell you. Growth comes through reflection. So if you're going to go into pain, then take the step forward and go into reflection. That's the place where all the gold and the diamonds lie. And I will be with you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Our goal was to give you pause, make you think about your life, and inspire you to say, wow, what if I tried to do that? If they can do it, so can I. Did it work? Let us know by finding us on social media at Gita Sidhu Rob or at Nosh Detox. We upload new shows every 2 weeks here. And if you start to miss us, check us out on YouTube.